Many entrepreneurs have an eidetic ability to see a way forward in real time. It's an instinct developed through consistency, focus, and determination. 24/7, 365, or 8,760 hours, year over year. That's why 8760 seeks to shed light on how leaders build businesses and brands, and clarity of the future is defined by a cipher of their minds. Thanks for coming. Today we have Bernd Ullmann, the $6 billion man, having worked with so many great celebrities and artists and transcendent brands in our culture, our lifestyle. It's a pleasure to have you here. 8760 really is a nod to the number of hours in a year. And you know, it's the idea that there's never a stop, you know, to the work that entrepreneurs and business men and women do to ultimately reach their goals and success. And it's more than 24/7, it's more than 365, it's year over year. And the element of entrepreneurship and business that we try and explore here is we've seen that there's this eidetic ability, you know, almost image recall in people's minds for these great entrepreneurs to take experiences that they've had and almost compile them as data points, right? So that when they're faced with new decisions in the future or new challenges, new scenarios, they can almost subconsciously recall these prior experiences. And that's what informs what oftentimes, you know, they call gut. Very excited to have you. Thank you for coming. We have a bit of a background from some of the work that we've done, but I think when look at you being able to bring brands, major celebrities, major businesses to the world, from J-Lo and Marc Anthony and Damon John, FUBU, working with Tommy Hilfiger. I mean, the list is endless. So tell us a bit, you know, tell our audience a bit that may not be familiar, kind of how you got your start and really how it now has manifested into this amazing, successful brand, you know, the chief brand accelerator, if you will, and just a little bit of a history and background.
Sure. Well, thanks, BJ. I am super excited to be here.
Thank you.
This is great. It's going to be fun. So I've been looking forward to sitting down with you based upon, you know, some of our history and the work. I feel that we are kindred spirits here.
Yeah. So Agreed.
Anyway, yes, a little bit about the journey. So I guess I've always been kind of in brand management, brand acceleration, IP monetization, often, you know, with a bent towards licensing, with a focus on fashion, celebrity, and entertainment. And I would say, you know, I was an entrepreneur early on. So I, you know, if you go all the way back.
Yeah, what was that? What's that first entrepreneurial, yeah, exactly, you know, memory you have?
All the way back, I was in the business school in Copenhagen, Denmark. I'm originally Norwegian. Mm-hmm. So the accent you're hearing, I'm not from Brooklyn and I'm not from Bronx. This is a Norwegian accent that you're hearing. So I'm from Norway, but I went to school in Denmark. And as I was getting my MBA, I started my first real business. I'd dabbled in some stuff before, but the first real business was Scandinavia's first home delivery of pizza, Pizza Pronto.
Wow.
Yep. So, and I learned a lot of lessons, by the way, so I don't know it's time for all of them, but very quickly, just diving right in, I kind of sort of, you know, I was studying marketing and I was Norwegian, and pizza back then in Europe was viewed as Italian. And so the Norwegian with Italian product in Denmark, it was a compelling story. Mm-hmm. And this is like way back. It's before the internet. And the main source of information was newspapers.
Okay.
And, you know, in Copenhagen back in the day, we're now in the 80s, there was really one dominant newspaper. I went to them and pitched them an article about this young Norwegian. They bought it. So they came out, and I had exactly two pizza trucks with Pizza Pronto on the side, with our phone number. And I figured, you know, I was a genius.
Yeah.
I had pictures taken next to my truck with the phone number.
Yeah.
And I was so excited as I was waiting for this article to come out. I figured, I have it made. I said, I'm done already. And what I hadn't really, you know, thought about was people get their newspapers kind of like 6 a.m. in the morning. This is the weekend paper. I'm on the cover. So around 6:05, the phone started ringing. By 7 a.m., long before we were up and running, we typically started our business on, you know, sometime in the afternoon. By 7 a.m., the phone system had shut down. It was overwhelmed. It got back up in the afternoon in time for us to start doing business. I had to bring in friends and family and everybody to just help answering the phone. We got the trucks on the road. First, truck number one broke down. Then truck number two broke down. So we delivered soggy, cold pizzas 3 to 4 hours late. That was our debut.
Wow. Yeah.
That was my big,
that was far,
you know,
from the 30-minute guarantee Domino's was doing.
Exactly. So I learned a really important lesson. You get one shot at making a first impression, and you might as well make it a good one. I was not ready. But anyway, so that was the first entrepreneurial stint. I then moved to the United States, started my own business, Nor Partners, because we were 4 Norwegian partners.
Okay,
so
yeah.
Really a brilliant name, Nor Partners.
Scripted brand. You know? Yeah.
But you know, Nor, we had a great run. It was amazing. I learned a lot. This is like the mid-80s in L.A. It was a rather high-flying and exciting time. So met my, you know, lovely bride-to-be, and we're still together all these years later. Moved back to Norway for a couple of years, and then came back here. And really, the interesting part is, you know, going back to some of the questions and what informs what. One big step up, I had a couple of jobs, you know, but Nor Partners was really in the fashion industry.
Okay.
So, and it's funny how that goes. It was completely coincidental. That's another story that I normally don't tell. But the very, very fast version of that is it was kind of a dark night in a bar on Ibiza. And I was sitting with one of my very good friends, one of my best friends. He had started a home delivery business and I had started the pizza business.
Yep.
And we were probably quite a few beers in at this venture or juncture. And we were kind of like the only two guys from business school that started our own businesses. So can you imagine what would happen if we started a business together?
Yeah.
So we're like, okay.
Destiny.
Yeah,
destiny.
Clearly, right? Brilliant. So, but then he said the fateful words, well, but I don't want to be in the pizza business.
Okay.
So I could do no less. So I retaliated. I don't want to be in the home improvement business because that was his business. And I'm a fool because fast forward, he went back to that business and he is, you know, independently wealthy for years and years, you know. But be that as it may, so we needed a compromise.
Okay.
And the compromise was we were looking, hey, we're both wearing clothes. Fashion business. So that's coincidental, right? So Nor Partners was actually in the fashion business.
Okay.
So now fast forwarding, it's funny. Once you start with something, you get some core competency. You get some value in the market. There is a cost affiliated with changing, an opportunity cost. So the lowest hanging fruit for me at that time was clearly to stay in the fashion business. I had credibility and I had a market value that surpassed what it would have been if I was to go somewhere else.
Yep.
However, you know, so I, as I said, moved back to Norway, then came back to the States, still in the fashion industry. And then kind of leveraged some of the background and having started my own Nor Partners and took a meeting over at the Donna Karan Company. And I sought them out. They didn't have a job. And I went and I spoke to them. I pursued them on a number of occasions, befriended a couple of the senior, like, management, went in for coffee and said hi, that type of stuff. Yeah. Lo and behold, one day they had an opening. I was invited in for a formal conversation. And I left that day as corporate vice president of the Donna Karan company. And that was actually a big jump in terms of, you know, market value again, because now there is perceived credibility. So
association with the title and a well-known brand position.
Absolutely. Yeah. So the affiliation with an established brand increased my brand value, if you like. And then fast forwarding from there, that was great. And I had a really awesome run. I opened 85 of their flagship stores all over the world. Took their international division from less than 40 million wholesale to over 250 million wholesale. But then at one point I realized that what they really needed as a brand was kind of a steady hand on the tiller. Not too much innovation. They had plenty of innovation coming from Donna, who is a genius.
Yeah, they didn't need the accelerant anymore.
They did not need that. They needed just someone that could do, you know, business as usual type of stuff. And that wasn't exciting to me. So I started looking for something different, something new and fresh, something like, you know, bringing Scandinavia's first home delivery of pizza. What is new? What's fresh in the fashion industry? And I caught on to the emergence of a whole new shopping demographic. And this demographic, now that arena or genre is often referred to as streetwear, back then it was often referred to as urban, which, and by the way, urban is just something that the traditional market, we are desperately in need of handles. Everything needs to fit in the box, particularly for
the large retailers.
100%. So, you know, there were none of those consumers that woke up in the morning and said, well, I'm going to have myself some urban breakfast and listen to my urban music and put on my urban clothes. You know, that's not how, you know, they were just, you know, a young emerging demographic. But that emerging demographic had spawned a whole new lifestyle, born out of rap and hip hop. And particularly this brand was called FUBU, For Us, By Us, founded by Damon John. Now the people's shark on Shark Tank. Back then, founder and CEO of FUBU. And I became president of FUBU International. And Damon has been kind enough to credit me with taking FUBU from under 100 million wholesale to over 400 million wholesale. And clearly, I was just part of a team, but it was an amazing, you know, run.
Seeing him give you some very appreciative credit on some interviews and some videos. So I feel like you may be being a bit modest with your impact there.
He's a great guy. And it was a great team and it was a great time. But the visionary was him and the co-founders recognizing this emerging, you know, marketplace and shopping demographic. I left and only because there was an acquisition team and the CEO actually that hired me at Donna had gone to another company. He called me and said, hey, I'm over here now. And we're looking at this acquisition. We're not sure exactly what we're looking at. Okay. It would be great if you could come and talk to us. So I did. I joined the acquisition team. The company that was acquired was called Fat Fashions. Fat Fashions was founded by Russell Simmons and his wife, Kimora Lee Simmons. The brands were Fat Farm and Baby Fat. So I joined and I became president of Fat Fashions. Ran the company for approximately 5 years. What's not particularly well known is that, you know, that markets change. And at that point, Fat Farm had lost some of its luster. The company overall was losing, you know, probably a couple of million dollars. And we ended up changing the operating model entirely. And that was tough. I walked probably 80 employees out the door, thanked them for their services. Never, you know, a good or exciting thing to do emotionally or personally, but it was the right thing to do for a business. We changed into a licensing model. We became 100% licensed. So we oversaw the brand, set all the standards for the brand, approved all the designs, retained 100% creative control, but had best-in-class operators that came in and ran the various products. And with that model, we became incredibly profitable. And we went from losing a couple of million dollars to seeing net operating earnings between $40 and $50 million annually.
It's a big turnaround.
Yeah, it was nice.
Yeah.
Then the mother company was acquired by Sun Capital out of Florida. And I partnered with Tommy Hilfiger, his brother Andy, and Joe LaMastra. And the four of us formed something called Star Branding. And the premise being that stars can be brands.
Mm-hmm.
And that's great. And by the way, when you partner with someone like Tommy.
Pre-influencer partners, right?
Yeah, yeah, no. And again, you know, a lot of credit goes to Tommy and Andy, particularly in that arena, because they had already been in the space dealing with celebrities for the purposes of, should we say, branding and positioning the Tommy Hilfiger brand, and done a bang-up job with that.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a natural progression with Star Branding. And when you partner with Tommy, you have to think big. Tommy has no interest in a nice little tidy $10 million business.
No.
So he is a big thinker, visionary. So we ended up creating a JV, the only JV they had, with the largest apparel manufacturer in the world, Li & Fung. And the JV was called Mesh Music Entertainment and Sport Holdings. So, and under that Mesh umbrella, we did a number of high-profile transactions. Best known was probably the one that you were referring to earlier that we did with Jennifer Lopez and husband at the time, Mark Anthony. That deal was billed as the largest celebrity deal ever done and valued at $3.5 billion. So it's pretty exciting stuff.
Big numbers.
Yeah. And then, you know, something really interesting happens when you publicly announced a multi-billion dollar deal with a celebrity. All of a sudden, there are a ton of other celebrities that are thinking...
Then you have that phone problem again.
They too wanted multi-billion dollar deals.
Yeah.
So, you know, we ended up with a massive deal pipeline. And in short order, we created collections for Universal Music Group and their talent, Steven Tyler, the Rolling Stones, American Idol. And then Eddie Lampert, billionaire chairman and CEO of Sears, called.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted me to join. I was CEO of Mesh, and he wanted me to become CEO of a new division he was launching called Shop Your Way Brands. And at the time, it didn't seem like a genius idea to become an actual Sears executive, because it looked like a little wobbly maybe. So I wasn't sure where they would end up. Mm. And hindsight is 2020, and it turns out that was probably pretty good.
Yeah, bet. I was going to say, it seems like you made the right decision.
I think so. But having said that, the project was exciting, you know, great team, great people. There was a cool vision. So I joined under contract. So I became acting CEO of Shop Your Way and launched then collections for Nicki Minaj and Adam Levine. And those collections jumped out to $200 million. It was a great run.
Mm-hmm.
And then ultimately in Star Branding, we had an exit. And fast forwarding, I worked with Bethany Frankel. She was one of the housewives from New York, created the brand Skinny Girl. And by the way, it's a story I love because, you know, a lot of my career, as I said, has been about brand management and brand acceleration and IP monetization. And the Bethany story, I think, is really cool because, you know, the housewives of New York or real housewives of New York, I don't know if you're familiar with the premise or the show, but...
I may be, but only through my wife.
Yeah, of course. Like everybody else.
In Potomac and L.A. and, you know, what others are there?
No, there are plenty. It's a huge franchise. But, you know, it is kind of the premise. It's a little bit like the ladies that lunch, you know, and then have maybe one cocktail too many at lunch, and then drama ensues.
Yep.
That seems to be a little bit of the premise of the show. And they were all, you know... supposed to be well-to-do ladies.
Mm-hmm.
So Bethany was not well-to-do when she joined the show. She had the gift of the gab, great, you know, on the show, but not wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
She needed a storyline. They all need storylines. So Bethany created the storyline of Skinny Girl. Skinny Girl cocktails, Skinny Girl margaritas, because the premise was the ladies should be able to go out and have a good time without packing on the pounds.
Yeah.
Great idea, great concept. So Skinny Girl cocktails were born. Three seasons in, she sold. Not the company, because there wasn't that much of a formal company.
Mm-hmm.
Not the whole brand. She sold just the alcoholic beverage rights to Beam Suntory for $100 million. That's the power of brand. That's the power of Bethany. And this is one of the reasons why I love branding. So all of a sudden, Bethany was certainly well-to-do.
Yeah.
So
manifested it.
100%. And by the way, going back, you know, to the Russell story, that's another great story. So I don't know if you know, but Russell Simmons, his original claim to fame was in music. And he founded Def Jam.
Mm-hmm.
He sold Def Jam, I want to say, for $100 million. And then Russell was the one that said, hey, there's more to this than just the music. This is a lifestyle. So he created then Fat Farm, mm-hmm. you know, the brand Fat Farm. And, you know, a lot of people are, Russell, man, what are you doing? You know, and there were some trade shows. The trade show was called Magic. He would go out there.
I think I remember they had a reality TV show like to coincide with that, too, because they would talk about Fat Farmer, promote it, and he had his daughters.
That's right.
In his designers.
100%. Yeah, no. Then, which, by the way, they're all really good.
Mm-hmm.
And even today, I would say, as much as our habits are changing dramatically, TV is still a pretty powerful medium, you know, to reach a wide audience. So that's definitely true. Russell, you know, goes out there. He sits small boots, you know,
mm-hmm.
10 by 10, 10 by 20, and people are shaking their heads.
Hey, what are you doing here?
Yeah. He stuck to his guns. Well, you know, he had done really, really well with his Def Jam. So, mm-hmm. you know, many people would have just rested on their laurels.
Yeah.
Not Russell. So he built out the Fat Farm brand. He had this vision, and there are a lot of lessons along the way. So Fat Farm was really the mantra was classic with a twist. So one of the logos was an upside down flag,
mm-hmm.
Only for the reason to speak to, hey, this is classic but with a twist.
Sure.
And one of the stories, and I, you know, I'm rambling on, but one of the stories, which I really love, is that back in the heyday of urban clothing, there was a lot of, you know, football jerseys and mm-hmm. hockey jerseys sold. And certainly it was a mainstay for FUBU.
I was going to say, that was the first thing that jumped to my mind was the FUBU jerseys when you said
millions
that.
And millions of dollars done in those jerseys. So Russell got an offer for an order for 50,000 hockey jerseys in one sitting, and those were not cheap. That's a huge order. It's a multi-million dollar order. And much to his credit, he never took the order because hockey jerseys were not on brand for him. It was not classic. And a little further down the line, you know, fast forwarding,
mm-hmm.
he sold Fat Fashions for $140 million. He didn't sell the company.
Yep.
He sold the IP rights to the Fat Fashions brand, Fat Farm and Baby Fat, for $140 million.
So how do you think he maintained that type of discipline? You know, I'm sure you've had to even kind of use that restraint yourself in some deals. I mean, this Sears example is one. You know, what do you think gives you that ability?
I think, honestly, it's about having a vision and having this, maybe there is a certain level of naivete, for lack of a better term, where you believe in that vision and you stick kind of to your guns. You're seeing something and you have the ability to visualize it. And it's kind of like, and I can't even remember the full example, but it was a sculptor, and he made something out of a huge, you know, rock, mm-hmm. and he made this, and I think it was a beautiful elephant, but it doesn't really even matter. And he was asked, like, oh my goodness, you took this piece of rock and you turned it into this gorgeous elephant. Like, how did you do it? And he said, I just removed every piece that didn't look like an elephant. So yep. Similarly, you know, mm-hmm. if you have the ability to see stuff that looks like noise, you can kind of stick to the vision. So certainly Russell had that ability. Like, honestly, so many of the, you know, strong personal brands that I've had the pleasure of working with, that's one of the things they all have in common.
That's interesting, because a lot of times, you know, as consultants or, you know, business advisors or even as marketers, you know, we're trying to sort of work backwards, right? What's the ultimate goal? What are we creating? Are we creating an elephant, or are we creating a sculpture of a woman, right? And then trying to lay out the steps to get there. So when you sort of flip it and you talk about how someone sees it just innately, and then there's steps taken to manifest it, that's really where I think there's this intrigue of how, right? I think there's some people have it. They just see it differently. And then others, I was going to go back to the pizza delivery story for a second, because when you talked about the fact that there was a lot of learnings, and then you sort of had mentioned something that in my mind, we talk about this concept of growth readiness, and a lot of brands or businesses come to us and, you know, they want X number of new sales or X number of revenue. And part of the conversation is, well, if we get you 100,000 new leads tomorrow, are you ready for that?
Yeah.
Right. And it kind of popped in my head with the phone conversation. Right. But what do you think that taught you, you know, when you, if you look back, right, and you kind of go through some of these other decisions that you made, the other deals that you've joined, like, was that something in that always in the back of your head, you know, we have to plan a bit, you know, more precisely, because these are some of the things that we're going to have to watch out for.
Yeah, no, that's obvious. That's why, you know, that there are a number, you know, of learnings there. So another one, I mean, you know, the first impression one is just huge, and it permeates everything I now do, to be honest. That's probably the biggest takeaway, because if it wasn't because, you know, home delivery of pizza is such a kind of innately strong idea, Pizza Pronto would have been out of business before it ever got off the ground.
Right.
But, you know, there were many other things, because, you know, you ended up as kind of my first real thing other than, you know, being a student and having a grand old time. And I kind of also, and I don't know if this is mine or I picked it up somewhere, but I feel like I was always focusing on you cannot guarantee the results, but you can always guarantee the efforts. So, and that has also been kind of a mantra of mine, that at the end of the day, there are many things that can influence the final outcome, but the things that you have control over, those are the things you should focus on. That's kind of what that says. You cannot guarantee the results, but you can always guarantee the effort. Mm-hmm. So you can control that. And, you know, and it's kind of like the old, you know, what is luck? It's when opportunity meets preparedness. And the harder you work, the luckier you get.
I mean, there's
so many of these, right? They all came out of that first stint for me and are kind of little mantras to live by.
What was the, it's interesting, because everything that you've sort of outlined has this through line of a mashup, you know, bringing Italian pizza to a new market, right? Even this crossover of urban or, you know, streetwear 100%. And, you know, this merge of cultures. And now more than ever, I think it's permeated across all of our culture. There's a much deeper integration of fashion and hip hop into, you know, mass market. But all of these seem to have this unification of different markets. Where do you think you found that as a starting point to see that this is where the opportunity is? It's that there's a proven need or proven desire, and others would feel that way too.
So quite frankly, what I actually think it is a certain fixation on newness or driving new or being on the cutting edge or maybe making a difference. Mm-hmm. You know, let's face it, you know, like the fashion industry, it's not exactly brain surgery. I was pre-med at one point. I thought I was going to be a brilliant, medical doctor. That didn't happen. Mm-hmm. So,
well, I was going to be a sports agent. So,
we both ended up okay. So I think in my case, I like newness and being part of something that's new and innovative and may bring some type of change. And I feel like that's what permeates a lot of this. And quite frankly, if you go back and you look at some of these other initiatives, they were also actually, you know, harking back to kind of the same. Like, for instance, the Jennifer Lopez, mm-hmm. Mark Anthony deal. It wasn't that we were that genius, but so the deal was done with, you know, a large national retailer, Kohl's.
Yep.
And at the time, Kohl's had a very large influx of Latin shoppers, you know. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, it was kind of like a one-off. We were, what we sometimes do, we're looking at the store, looking around. They had no organic or native Latin brands. So we're like, you have this customer that's coming in your store every day, spending a lot of money. But
and they're not seeing product that they actually,
not at all
resonate with.
Right? Yeah. And we took it one step further. It's like, hey, aren't you like deathly afraid? Aren't you like awake at night just waiting for them to wake up one day themselves and say, hey, why am I shopping here? Mm-hmm. They clearly don't care about me. You know, there are no organic, no native brands, no Latin brand. So we took that approach in our conversation with the CEO. And that clearly resonated.
Yeah.
So Jennifer Lopez.
A little bit of fear and urgency, right?
100%. Jennifer Lopez, Mark Anthony. Mm-hmm. Those were specifically geared towards a certain audience. They became, of course, complete global lifestyle brands worn by everybody. Mm-hmm. Because these are just, I mean, as celebrities go, great celebrities that speak to a very wide, audience. But the selling point, the opening the door, was this recognition. There is a new demographic now, mm-hmm. that is spending money in your stores, and you're not actually catering to them, which means that you're not really respecting them.
It's a great observation, and clearly, it speaks to the buying power of audiences, right? And
100%.
When you're not recognizing where it's coming from, there's missed opportunity.
Yeah.
For the celebrity factor, right, clearly has had a big impact on the success of many of these. We've kind of lived through this pure celebrity spokesperson face of brand, and then, a mega influencer model of a micro and nano, and now there's an influencer creator, for everything and everyone and everywhere, and we're also seeing this evolution of the marketplace where there's so many options, right, because of Amazon and because of these other distribution channels. How do you see the level of influence celebrity continues to have over the next, 5-10 years, as compared to, some of these brands that are emerging? They don't necessarily have the clout associated with them, but they have some of the smarts to get in front of folks, when there's a buying need.
Yeah. So that's a good question. It's a very complex question because the market has obviously changed. We've been through so many iterations. Once upon a time, there was something called the supermodel. Mm-hmm. You don't hear that reference anymore.
Yeah.
We don't necessarily have supermodels, but we have people, maybe they are creators, mm-hmm. that, let's say, now utilizes a platform called OnlyFans. They're making more money than any of the supermodels ever did.
Yeah.
So there are completely different ways to monetize and get in front of audiences now that we never had before. So I think the marketplace has probably never been as democratic as it is today.
It's fair, yeah.
And we're probably living in what I would call the creator, you know, economy.
Mm-hmm.
Because anyone can now be a creator and anyone can find a way to monetize and leverage social channels. Having said that, there are a couple of things that still holds true. So, for instance, nothing sells product as well as product. So if you don't have a great product, you know, yeah, you can market and you can get in front of someone. But to get repeat business, you kind of have to have a great product. So that's kind of, I think, one thing that's true. Another thing that's true is that great brands, they have to be aspirational and they have to be credible and authentic. And great brands will always somehow, I think, find a way of breaking through all the noise. But there is a thing, you know, so great brands enjoy trust in the mind of the consumer.
Mm.
But so does or do celebrities and the right influencers. And the interesting thing about trust, and I think it was Carlos Santana that said this when I was meeting with him, trust leads to thrust. And I think that's really well put. Mm-hmm. So if you can get in front of an audience and if you can establish an emotional connection, this is important, then you will have the benefit of trust, and trust leads to thrust.
It's the biggest way to amplify or burn up a poor product, right? Amplifies a great product and kills a poor one real quick.
Yeah, no, it's true. And by the way, the whole thing about emotion, think about, you know, some of the leading brands today, and this is a model that's been used for years and years, you mm-hmm. know, like Coca-Cola, have a Coke and a smile.
Yep.
They're not saying, hey, this has a great this, or, you know,
mm-hmm.
then. And it kind of goes back to kind of the old, you know, marketing. And it gets almost the, for lack of a better term, it's kind of like, I don't want to call it dogma, but it's one of these like overarching principles of marketing. And if you're selling a drill,
mm-hmm.
sell the whole.
Yeah.
You sell the results.
Yeah.
So you don't talk about, you know, how...
It's the sell me this pen conversation.
Yeah, but it's like sell the results, mm-hmm. you know, and it matters. So with emotive brands, that's what they do. They talk about a feeling. How will you feel if you use this product? And I think that rings true for both celebrities and great brands. So basically, I think the consumer, they may forget what you say,
mm-hmm.
and they may even forget what you do. But they will not forget how you make them feel.
It's true.
Yeah. So that's pretty profound, I think. So,
yeah, absolutely. So. No, absolutely. I think it's a really good point. And, you know, when you think of the trust factor, you know, it's tying back through into it has to connect with the lifestyle that consumer's in. And, you know, the celebrity factor is the ultimate beacon of, you know, the ideologic lifestyle that person wants, you know, it is always the dream world of many.
As we said, great brands are aspirational.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
but of course, it's funny the kind of juxtaposition to that is you cannot necessarily just take any celebrity and apply them to any product. That won't work. The consumers are way too smart. And for instance, I mean, if you think back now, it was back in like the urban days,
mm-hmm.
Eminem, you know, the artist.
Yeah, he got called out for a few different.
But yeah, for sure. But mm-hmm. at one point, he was the fastest selling artist, mm-hmm. bar none.
Mm-hmm.
He was so big.
And he was polarizing for some obvious reasons. And, you know, it was compelling because there was a whole area of the world that was so excited that there was, you know, a different type of representation and that there was permission now to be, you know, in this lifestyle. And, you know, there was resistance from the other side.
100%. But so here's the interesting piece. So no different than some of the others. Mm-hmm. He launched his own collection. He has an alter ego, Slim Shady.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't know. There was a Slim Shady collection. But the Slim Shady collection was never very successful. And I think one of the reasons we talked about credible, authentic, and aspirational. Now, I don't know, but it might be that in the mind of the consumer, was he aspirational as a designer? Was it credible that he, if you looked at him, was someone that cared about clothing? And so those are some of the interesting things. The consumers are super smart. They know.
When you were talking about that earlier, in my mind, I didn't want to say any names because you're probably friends with them, so I don't want to insult anyone. But, you know, you see some of these commercials, you know, now for it's mostly in pharma, and you're kind of, you know, rolling your eyes about these endorsements. And, you know, you feel like there's almost something, you know, that there's a big money play there that, you know, hey, I don't know that I could say no either.
You know, but the funny part is those partnerships never work as well as you would think because the consumers perceive them as inauthentic.
Mm-hmm.
So again, if it's not credible, it typically won't deliver the same type of results.
So I have one more question for you.
Yeah.
Many of the articles and references of your success and stories talk about the man behind the brands. What's kept you behind? You know, what? How come you haven't? I don't know that I could sit there and have, you know, Damon publicly, you know, praise me and thank me for helping him grow, and then watch him on Friday nights on Shark Tank and not think, well, how come I can't get in that seat?
So you know what? That actually never bothered me. So maybe it's a little cultural being from Norway. Yeah. We actually have something there called Janteloven, which most people probably haven't heard about here, but it's kind of a fundamental principle of don't think you're better than anyone and all of that stuff. But so I don't know that it's that. Ultimately, I obviously left, so I had kind of bigger visions than that. But it is also a recognition, and it's a recognition of the importance of, in this case, the celebrities, being and playing the role that they're supposed to play. You know, they are supposed to be in the limelight. They are supposed to be the halo for the brand. They are the tip of the, you know, spear for the business. So I think if I was to try to compete with that, it confuses the roles. And I don't think it would be helpful in kind of optimizing and you know, again, I'm there to try to build something lasting and meaningful and accelerate. And quite frankly, more often than not, what you really want in this successful partnership is that you're a great celebrity, continue to be a great celebrity. Now, and by the way, you are creative. I don't have a problem with the creative, you know, celebrity. It's very often a namesake brand. Clearly the vision for the brand needs to come from the celebrity. What I do is help distill it. So we often talk about, you know, brand DNA, right? And what is brand DNA? It is really what are the different facets that make up the brand. So now you take a persona and you say, what does this persona embody? And then you know, part of what I do is I try to capture that and distill it into, okay, what does that look like as, to say, a fashion brand or a global lifestyle brand? You know, I think if I didn't play that part, but try to kind of quasi play the part of the celebrity, I think the wires would get crossed.
Keeps you focused.
Yeah, I don't think it would be helpful, quite frankly. So no, I'm perfectly happy to be the man behind the brands. And the reality is, it's not even only when you're dealing with, personal brands. I think it permeates everything. So, for instance, we were talking about earlier, newness and being on the forefront. I'm spending a lot of time now in the world of Web3, mm-hmm. Working with a company called Cosmic Wire. Cosmic Wire has a founder, and the founder's name is Jared Fink. And to me, Jared Fink is Steve Jobs. If you understand what mm-hmm. I mean.
Yeah.
He's the visionary. It's his creation. My job is to help amplify that. I am not there to compete with Jared.
Mm-hmm. Operationalize the vision it can be realized.
And quite frankly, try to put it on steroids. To accelerate, but if that makes sense.
It does, absolutely. Yeah.
So that's how the man behind the brands came about.
Who's on the bucket list? Who's someone you'd love to work with that, if they're watching?
Yes, I don't know that there is a bucket list per se, because I've had the benefit of working with some of the biggest and greatest talent, but there are some interesting people that obviously have that are very accomplished, and I think it could be fun to do something. I like to be with leaders in their space, so that's really it. I
with all the folks that have learned many things from you, who have you learned the most from, you think?
That's interesting. It's a really good question. I think, I learn something every time. Mm. Sometimes what not to do.
Sometimes more valuable.
might be.
Not at the time.
But I have to say, someone like a Tommy Hilfiger, probably... the one that I may have learned the most from Tommy, only from the vantage point of the way he thinks. He is such an incredibly clear thinker. And he has this uncanny ability to take really, really complex situations and distill them into something that's very simple. We might be sitting in a meeting and someone speaks for 10 minutes. And finally the person is done, and Tommy will say, "So what you are saying is," and then boom, 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 and it would have taken 30 seconds to recap the whole thing, and it would be crystal clear all of a sudden to everybody.
For everyone, yeah.
100%. Yeah. And the other thing that I think he has this really great aesthetic. So, for instance, I remember we were working on a deck and a presentation, and we couldn't get it quite right. And we wanted it to be exciting, and we had strong imagery. But there were some words trying to deliver the message. And Tommy came in, and he looked at it. He took out every word except one word and made that one word bigger. Mm. And it was like, pow, mm-hmm. type of, strong, exciting, very kind of uplifting message. That was really powerful. It's really informed a lot of what I've done. Everybody, as I said, like Damon John is amazing. Also clearly a visionary.
Yeah.
And really a good person, does a lot of good in the world. Same thing goes for Russell Simmons. It's like, it's hard to, like there's... You learn something.
We won't twist
everybody.
Your arm. You don't have to have a favorite.
No, but exactly.
Get you in trouble.
No, that's not. But there are a number of great, great people that I have had the pleasure to work with.
It's incredible the list of folks that you've had dealings with, and every time we get on the phone, it's exciting to hear who you're talking to next, and we always look forward to that. But appreciate your time and really. A great conversation. Loved hearing more about how you became and continue to build on that $6 billion mark.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure, BJ. It's fun.
Thank you.
Thank you.